in my mind, I go, this is coming back from her childhood. She's very defensive. She doesn't want to be hurt again. And even the slightest thing to me is very minor. To her, it's big. And I don't criticize it. I just have to learn to accept it.
Welcome to Intrinsically Motivated, where we have conversations with experts in the field of addiction, recovery, and those personally affected by it, as we seek to mobilize the church to replace addiction and mental health challenges with flourishing. On today's episode, Uplift Appalachia President Andy Clements sits down with longtime friends Frank and Sally Bussey. After reading Andy's book, The Trauma-Informed Church, Frank and Sally realized how early life adversity had shaped their lives. Join us as they open up about their journey, the struggles they faced, and the breakthroughs that have gotten them to where they are today. I'm Tucker Clements, audio engineer and editor for Uplift Appalachia, and this is Intrinsically Motivated.
I am here with Frank and Sally Bussey, who I have known for, oh my gosh, a very long time. I was 15 years old, I'll say it that way. And I'm 63, do the math. And they are too, of course. But one of the things I wanted to talk about at first is a little bit of how we got to know each other before we even dive in. And then we'll talk about some other things. But I was a campus life kid, Youth for Christ kid in high school. And so you, Frank, were campus life director. And you were Mama Bussey, his wife, and then went on to be staff for Campus Life. And we had our staff meetings in your basement, and Mama Bussey ran us home because it got late and the kids were in bed. These are the things that I remember, because we would stay too late and too loud. But tell me a little bit about, I guess, what got you there. But I will say also that I became a Christian through that ministry. And I would love to, do you remember that at all, Frank? Do you remember that?
Not really.
Okay. There were a lot of us. So I came to Campus Life as a kid because it was a place that the cool kids went, and I wanted to go where the cool kids went. And, then I went to Gatlinburg, which is funny because I live near Gatlinburg now. And,
For winter holiday.
And the guy that I was dating made a profession of faith there. And I said, that's interesting. And several things had kind of drawn me in that direction, but I didn't even know what it meant. And so I cornered you after the first meeting after winter holiday and said, okay, I just got to get this straight. I got to do this thing, whatever it is. So you led me through. We prayed together. The rest is kind of history, very circuitous history. But I credit you with answering all my questions and praying with me that night. That was January 3rd of 77, if that dates us.
Wow.
So, yeah, been a bit.
And we haven't said, Frank and I lived in Indianapolis, Indiana, and then Youth for Christ said, we want you to go down to Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Can I say Roll Tide? I'll say Roll Tide here.
Yeah.
You can edit it out if you have to.
And that was so fun, going to the South. I mean, it really
was. And
here
you are still in the South. It must have been a lot of fun.
Well, it was, because we were coming from Indianapolis where it was cold winter. So coming to Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And one of the first people in our neighborhood said, we've got tickets for the Alabama-Auburn game.
Ooh, that's a start.
In Birmingham, Alabama then. Where was that, Frank?
Legion Field.
Yes. And that was our first experience. And boy, did we fall in love with Alabama. Roll Tide.
There you go. Okay, we might have to keep it.
We enjoyed Tuscaloosa a lot. It was a new culture. I'll say both my parents were from southern Arkansas. Okay. And I was conceived probably down there and delivered in Kansas City, which was my hometown. So I accepted Christ in Youth for Christ there at a rally, and then came back after school to work for them. So I was in Youth for Christ. I've been in Youth for Christ for going on almost 30 years.
Wow.
And yet, so Tuscaloosa was 11 wonderful years working with high school kids, let's say.
And we
just had a lot of unique fun things there. And the high point every week was just what you call the campus life meeting, which met in different homes. And then I recruited and trained a lot of college students to be also to run clubs. So it was highly interesting, and you were one of them.
I was one of them, and then I married one of them. And, you know, we have such intertwined history, such intertwined history.
Did you ever go cave exploring with us?
One time. I have the pictures to prove it. I was claustrophobic before. I am still. I have kids. My two younger kids love to go cave exploring. I have never been again. I don't plan to ever go. You can bury me there, but that's the only way you get me in there.
So. Well, I've taken hundreds and hundreds of teenagers cave exploring. Even talked my wife into going once, and she made out a will.
See, we're the smart ones.
She knew she was gonna
survive. I made a will out because I had three children, and if I was going to die in a cave, I wanted someone to take care of the children.
This is logic. This is logic.
So anyway, we did a lot of unique things there and just enjoyed it so much.
Yep.
We had Hawaiian luau's.
I have pictures from that as well.
Yes. Hamburger bashes.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And what about Halloween?
Yes.
How many thousands and thousands of high school kids went
scream
through?
In the dark.
Scream in the dark.
Yep.
And God later convicted me of that and had to change to a fun house. We built relationships with the teenagers and with the volunteers, our college students. In fact, we had the college students over at our house most Wednesday nights for a Bible study. And that was fun. And I liked a lot of your questions. In fact, for a while, we just the two of us would meet down at Big Boy.
Yep.
Restaurant.
Have a biscuit.
And we would answer questions. And it was fun. I really highly enjoyed it. And I like the fact that you were asking good questions and you were absorbing what was being said, not just glibly accepting it, but just asking great questions. You had a good mind on you.
And also having the college students from Alabama in our house every Wednesday night said something to our three children. Because they saw, well, these college students, they're really cool. And look, they love Jesus. So to us, that was a real plus for our children to see that. I do want to go back to how Frank and I met, because he is from Kansas City and I'm from Ohio. And he went to Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, and I did too. And that's where we met.
I don't think I ever knew that.
Yes.
I knew you were in Chicago.
She was looking for a husband there.
And I saw him, and I liked the way he looked from the back. And so...
Don't edit that.
Not much for the face, though.
And so there was a basketball game, and so I said, oh, there's going to be a basketball game tonight. We're going to meet at the post office, hoping that he would. And so we all... 50 of us walked over to the post office, walked over to the basketball game. And the whole time I was cheering, I kept looking to see if he was looking at me. I never noticed that he did. So when it was over with, I was getting my stuff together and going back to the dorm. And he came up and he said, are you ready? And that was the beginning of our relationship.
Well, I want to go back even further because one of the things that I remember just in the last few years, I've been studying addictions. But I remember from when I was in high school, before I was ever on staff, you had talked at times about being raised in a house with an alcoholic father. And you said it not in passing so much, but not in detail. But I don't know, do you have siblings? Do you have what? Tell what you want to tell of your early childhood. Not the whole thing, because that might take a little long. But
I'm an only child because my mother would not have any more children because of my dad's alcohol. He was Air Force. In fact, he was going through PTSD from the Philippines in World War II. Bombs had been landing all around him. He'd see parts of his friends just destroyed. And he was essentially self-medicating himself with alcohol. So he was that. In fact, when he died of cirrhosis of a liver in the VA hospital, he was reliving war experiences. I didn't realize that. But the neat thing about it, I mean, well, how would I say it? He would sometimes come to my football games drunk and embarrass me. And one time I told him, I said, when my mom died of cancer, I said, Dad, I'm glad Mom died and got away from you. I felt so mad at him. And yet years later, I was in a in a Bible study teaching thing, and they confronted, well, the passage confronted me in Matthew chapter 5, where it says, when you go to the to offer your gift on the altar and realize your brother has something against you, be reconciled to your brother, then come offer your gift. And it's just like I got spiritually stabbed. I go, oh, my lands, I hate my father, and I can't do anything until I get that straightened out. So I said, yeah, God, I will. But do you put it off? Oh, yeah, I put it off. And yet here I was in a car one time on Father's Day. My dad called me. We were living in Iowa at the time, Cedar Rapids. And so God said to me, okay, Frank, do it. I didn't want to do it. Do it, Frank, if you're serious. I said, okay. Dad, would you please forgive me for not giving you the love, honor, and respect I should have been giving you? There was quietness on the phone. And I said, Dad, I need to hear from you that you forgive me. He said, oh, son, you don't need to. You don't need to. And I said, Dad, yes, I do. I need to hear you tell me that you'll forgive me. He said, oh, yes, son, yes, yes, yes. Well, after that, he came up to see me right away to see us within the month. And did he bring his alcohol? Oh, yeah. And God convicted me. He says, Frank, the problem is not the alcohol. It's the relationship you have with your dad. And so when I went back to Kansas City, he said, son, would you go to the VFW with me? Well, that's, for me, in my opinion, was veterans of foreign drunks. So I didn't know much about it. So I said, sure, Dad, I'll go. And he said, really? So I went there, and he started introducing me around to his friends. And he said, oh, you're the preacher. Your dad talks about you all the time. And I go, wow, that's interesting. So we were reconciled. And when he died later, like I said, in the VA hospital from the alcoholism, we were reconciled. I have no regrets of doing that. And yet God forced me into doing it. First of all, the conviction of the scripture. Secondly, the obedience to what he said to do. And then doing it. And I am so thankful. In fact, right in the last years, we've been working with military ministry, teaching recruit Sunday school classes at Fort Jackson. And many of these young men and women join the Army just to get away from their parents. And so I would share with them that story. And they would get choked up. And some of them said, boy, you're talking about me. And I said, you need to call your dad and straighten things out. And several of them did. And at graduation time, some of the parents were there, and the fathers would come up and thank me for helping their son straighten out with them. So it's a big problem, not just in my life, and it's all over. We all have a problem of getting away from our fathers. I wish I had a good background, but God even used the trauma and the bad things in my life to help others. So thank you, Lord, for having that opportunity, and I love my dad. It's interesting, though, that afterwards my aunt said, do you realize your dad was going to be a preacher? I go, what? I said, yeah, he was going to be a preacher. Back when he was in high school, he was ahead of his Methodist youth group, and he was going to do that. I was going, really? And says, yet he went into the Army and got into alcohol, and he had to turn his back on that. And I go, wow. So it's interesting what God does in our lives and how he uses our past, because I remember with my father, he wanted to be a good father, but didn't know how. And he was all wrapped up in his problems. And I've had the privilege, well, I'll just say, for several years taught seminars for the National Center for Fathering, going around the country teaching fathers how to father. And it is so much fun. And I can relate some of these stories of what God taught me. And the men will go, oh, yeah, Frank, that's you're talking about my life. And like one man said, I want to be a good father. I don't know how. Is there any hope for me? I said, yeah, there is, if you want to, and you'll follow what the Bible teaches you. So long story, but very meaningful in my life. And God taught me that way to be very cautious, but very diligent and wanted to be a good father. I told God, my favorite parenting verse in the Bible is James 1:5. If any man lacks wisdom, let him ask of God who gives to all men liberally. Wow. Because many times I prayed that. I said, God, please help me understand this daughter. I don't have a clue what to do. And God would give me answers. And so it's a good thing. God wants us to be parents, good parents, his way. I can keep talking, but that's good enough.
No, that was great. You got in. There were several things that I was going to ask you about, and you worked those all in beautifully. But one of the things that you did, you're segueing quite nicely into one of the things that really motivated me to want to interview both of you on this podcast, and that is, you said you experienced traumatic things that now you understand better that have prepared you for the things that you're doing. And one of the things I recently learned about, and apparently you fairly recently learned about as well, is the background here in your own household with Sally, that also had some traumatic things happen in her past. And I'll give a shameless plug here. As I was one of your Campus Life kids and just considered you family, wrote the book, The Trauma-Informed Church, and sent you a copy, just more of a, and you probably didn't even know this, more of a, look, Dad, are you proud of me?
And we're very proud.
Thank you. But not knowing at all how impactful that would be for the two of you. And so I guess it's kind of a way to get a testimonial of sort of the impact that information can have on people. But the way I kind of like to start is, if you are willing, Sally, I know now that you do share your story some, and I would love it if you would just share.
Let me say something first.
Sure, yes.
Shortly after I became a Christian, one of my new Christian friends said, are you praying for your wife? And I go, what? And he said, do you realize the girl you're going to marry is alive right now, going through problems, trials, and temptations? Shouldn't you be praying for her? And I just thought she'd poof into existence when I met her. And I said, okay. Well, here I'm from Kansas City. I was praying for the wife. My wife is from Ohio. We meet in Chicago, and it's like two gloves fitting together. It's just like, thank you, Lord. We had similar backgrounds in a way, and yet I'm so thankful for her. And so now let's listen to her.
Well, the one thing I want to just add to that, when we met at Moody, we both knew we wanted to go in Christian work. So when we met, that was the number one thing in our life. We want to go into Christian work, and Moody prepares you for that.
And I will say that you taught us that when I was in high school as well, to be praying for our spouse. Must be working. I've been married 42 years. So,
really?
Okay. Yep. And you taught him that too, I'm sure.
So,
much of the things I teach is what God has already taught me. Mm-hmm. And I'm sharing it. So when the person who hears it realizes it's not just Frank Bussey talking.
Right.
It's this new friend, this man is going to talk to me. It's like somebody, I've had a lot of dealings with youth having problems with Christianity, let's say, and asking deep questions. And I love dealing with that. And God motivated me to go into apologetics as far as answering tough questions. I like that. But God always gives answers. Mm-hmm. And it's never a matter of how smart Frank is. It's like, what have you taught me, God? How can I get an answer to this? Because I don't have the answer.
James 1:5, my favorite.
Yeah. So I remember one teenager, he came up. The mother told me, said, well, Greg, he's not a believer. He doesn't believe in Christianity. He goes to church out of honor to me, but he just sits there. So I went up to him afterwards in one of the sessions and said, here, you got some questions about Christianity. He said, yeah, I got some biggies. And so he's going to give me four biggies that I couldn't answer, he thought. One of them answered right away. Another one's a tough one. I had to study the Bible and so forth. And several of them, I said, I don't have a clue how to answer this question. Give me wisdom, James 1:5. And then I go, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good answer. And I got back together with him a couple of weeks later, and I said, I've got some answers for you. And I remember him saying, oh, yeah, I'm sure you do, sarcastically said. And I gave him the answers, and he goes, that makes sense, Well, he told his girlfriend that if she became a believer, he would divorce, he would get rid of her. So she wouldn't make a decision. So I went to the school the next day. It's while we were living in Indianapolis. And I saw her in the hallway at school. And she says, "Oh, Frank, I want to become a believer. I said, "Well, what about Greg?" He said, "Oh, he did last night when you were talking." I go, "Wow, thank you, Lord." And again, I'm not patting myself on the back. I'm just saying, thank you, Lord, for the privilege of being used by you with somebody else. That's neat. That's my life.
Yep. And you're still doing it all the time.
Love it. Yeah. Love it, love it, love it. Looking forward to seeing what he's going to do next.
Even this year, to share how he's still doing it.
Yep. And I know you've both told me a bit about your growing up and so forth and what you share. But I would like for you to share that, but then I also would like to talk about how y'all have navigated that as you sort of have come to grips the last few years with this. So,
well, I've been able to share this story to women's retreats and women's meetings. And the reason is I tell them I was a broken girl, and I realize that there are other women out there who are broken girls. And the song I use is from Matthew West, where it says, "Look what he's done to you. It isn't fair. Your light was bright and new, but he didn't care. He took the heart of a little girl and made it grow up too fast. Now, words like innocent don't mean a thing. You hear the music play, but you can't sing. Those pictures in your mind keep you locked up inside your past. This is the story of a broken girl." And I was that broken girl. Because when I was growing up at home, I had an older brother, and it was a small house, and my brother and I were in the same bedroom. And my brother molested me for years and years. And if I would say anything, even to my parents, nobody believed me, or it was pushed aside. I remember I wanted to die. I wouldn't eat. I would take food that was put on the plate and I would put it in my pocket and then go to the bathroom and throw it down the toilet because I wanted to die. When you are a broken girl and you have this happening in your life and no one's listening to you, who do you turn to? It was horrible, horrible.
Yeah, and I know one of the things that you said when we were talking a few minutes ago is that you don't have other memories from your childhood.
None.
That it's like you've just blocked out the whole thing, except for that, which you have not yet been able to block out.
Right. And so I did. So I even going growing up, there wasn't anybody I could share this with who listened to me. Going to Moody, never shared it. You don't sit over a cup of coffee and say, "Let me tell you what happened to me at home," because let me tell you, my brother was at Moody while I was at Moody. So I still wasn't away from him, but I was at Moody, of course. He was older, graduating. And so I just blocked this horrible, horrible thing away from me. And that's sort of what happens when you have such a traumatic thing in your life. That's the only way you can survive. I remember thinking at times, I don't know how to block it out. When you sleep, when you eat, things that come to your mind constantly.
And you said earlier, too, that even now, and you are a bit older than I am, and I am 63, that still every day that comes to mind somehow.
And absolutely.
And so you see, you think of people, "Oh, well, that was then, and I'm sure they're over it now. They seem fine," when there's not a over it fine.
No.
Right.
There is never an over it. And because every day something will trigger it, something you see on TV, something you see on a billboard, and that is there. The one thing I learned through going through counseling, and it wasn't until after I was married with children that I finally was able to go through counseling. And that was, I went to a counselor because my father had died. And so I just went to this counselor to just walk through the sorrow of a father dying. And at the end, he said, after two or three sessions, he said, "Sally, is there more?" Wow. Everything flooded over me because, yes, there was so much more that no one knew. And I was able then to tell him all the horrible, horrible things that no one knew. My husband did not know. Nobody knew, because that was something, who's going to listen to you? Doctors, when I went to them, didn't listen. So that was the beginning, though, of my healing, was the counselor walking me through it and letting me know, I'm not a broken girl anymore. I hear you. And he said, Sally, you have a story to tell, because we're full-time with Campus Crusade now. I have three children. He said, Sally, you have a story to tell of how you broke that chain. Because most girls that come to me or women are either alcoholics, they're in prostitution. He said, they're in all kinds of awful things, but you broke that chain. And they need to hear that that chain can be broken. And so I look at it. Many of you make a chain at Christmas time out of paper construction. And I like that at Christmas time, because that chain is new and I broke the awful, evil chain that was that in my life.
So how old were you when you went to counseling?
I was in my, I got to think.
60s, 70s.
Yeah, not 70s. I would say, yeah, 60s.
60s. How did you share that with Frank?
Well, I remember after the counseling, I would sit in the car and just cry, because it just all came out. And you're all by yourself and you're telling this. And so then I went home and I shared with him every week, because you don't do it all at once. You need to walk through it. You need to walk that horrific journey. And so I would tell him, and he was shocked. But he knew there was something, because I never would talk about Ohio. He could tell I didn't want to go to Ohio. And he sensed that, but didn't ever push it with me. Just let it go. And even my daughter knew there was something there, but she never pushed it. Now, we have two sons, and boys wouldn't have picked up on that, but my daughter did.
And I learned never to ask questions, simply to listen to what she chose to relate to me. But I didn't want to pry into pain. I just had to be supportive and help her through the problem.
See, and that's great, because so many people are uncomfortable. And this is, I don't even remember if this is in the book. I think it is. I wrote it, but I don't have to remember it now, because I can go back and read it. Is when they hear really hard things, they get uncomfortable and immediately want to fix so that they don't have to feel it. Not so the other person that experienced it doesn't feel it, but they want to feel more comfortable and go to fixes. So just to even have the wisdom to pace yourself and listen without, you know, leaping in is, I mean, that's got to be some God-given wisdom there, because that's, I don't think that's natural. I don't think that's natural.
The Lord shuts my mouth sometimes, and I'm thankful.
But it took a long time. And I think one of the things, anybody who's been sexually molested, and especially if it's a family member, how many times I said, they never protected me. These are my parents. They never protected me. They never believed. And that's hard, because those are the people that need to protect you. As a child, who else is going to protect you?
Right. So I'm interested, because I'm actually working with a young woman right now, almost the exact same situation. And she's married now and has her own kids. But that makes it so hard for her to trust God, because she comes from the God knew this was happening. My parents knew this was happening. They didn't protect me. He didn't make them to protect me. How can I trust him to protect me now, or to protect my kids? And she's more worried about the kids. It's like, so did you wrestle with that? And do you have an answer for her? I would love to take it back.
No, but I was much older than probably what she is now. And so my faith in God and my training and my being in the Word is what I went to. I mean, that was my salvation. God is my Father. But I had to wrestle. Why did God allow that to happen? So I had to wrestle with that too. Do I understand that today? I really do, because I think it's made me the person I am in ministry. I'm very tender towards especially the recruits and young men and women. I know that they're maybe coming from a background like I had. And so I can listen to them. Not that they will share that, but there's just that tenderness. I'm drawn towards them. When I give my talk at church, I can't tell you how many women come up to me and say, I have a similar story. Thank you. Because we sit in a church pew and I don't turn to the person next to me and say, let's go out for coffee and let me tell you what happened to me as a child.
Right. Right.
They don't share that.
Right. And I wish that we had churches that were safe enough and open enough that whatever your stuff is, we could trust each other with it. That's one of the things that we're trying to build at Uplift with churches is this culture of that, rather than, like I mentioned tonight, we have a recovery, we call it a recovery group. We call it Renew, for whatever you need to be renewed from. But trying to build that culture, but we don't want it just to be, oh, a meeting we go there to do, but it's just the way we are, that we know each other and trust each other and share with each other and can be that strength or listening or just be, yeah, is what we would like to do.
Yeah, a thought just came to my mind. We get phone calls all the time from people calling up and saying, hey, because we do married seminars to military all over the world. We've been all over the world. And I'll just tell you two quick stories. One of them, we got the phone call. Young man called. He said, hi, my name is so-and-so. I just graduated from the Citadel. My wife also graduated. Citadel is in Charleston, mm-hmm. South Carolina. We've been married 6 months. And he said, she just found something out about me. May we come see you? So I always say, yes, come to Columbia. We'll go to McAllister's and have tea. And so we're sitting there, and this good-looking couple comes in. He's tall, and she's beautiful, but their faces are sad. And immediately they sit down, and she said, we've only been married 6 months. I'm a believer, and he's a believer. We were even in Campus Crusade together at the Citadel. I asked him before we married, have you ever been involved in pornography? And he said, no. Because she said, my father was. So I didn't want to marry into that. But she came home one day, and he was on the computer, and she saw, confronted him. And he was devastated. He loves her. He said, I will get rid of everything. He took his computers from home, packed them up, and he said, I'll only study at school. And that's what he did. So they're seeing us now, and we can only go so far with them because, again, they need then to go on to people who are professionally can counsel them. But he said to me, which reminds me of what I went through, he said, when I'm driving down the street, there's a billboard, and they're talking about suntan lotion, and there is this woman in a bikini. Bingo. I'm very involved in pornography then. My mind, he said, every minute I suffer from that. And so it goes in other areas. You know, we can have other areas like that. Another quick story, we were at a meeting and this couple were going to be missionaries with a certain denomination. And they found out we did marriage counseling. We came home and got the phone call and we were in Charlotte, and we live in Columbia, and he said, would you and Sally meet with us? And we said, sure. We met them that weekend, didn't know them until that weekend, met with them. They're ready for the mission field in 6 weeks. And he said, I'm heavy into pornography. So I'm just saying it goes so many different areas.
Right, right. And that is one of the most, I guess, secularly acceptable addictions. You know, people, we talk about addictions and we know, and that is one of those things that we have the research on, that the way pornography affects your brain and the ways it fires and all of that is the same with pornography. It can be with food. It can be with alcohol. It can be with opiates, whatever, that addictions are addictions are addictions. And so in fact, a lot of the church that we attend, a lot of the the addiction ministry that has happened up to this point has been with a large group of the men that went ahead and confessed that they were addicted to pornography. And so there's a large support network there of men. And the things they've gotten rid of, they have flip phones, you know, just great.
Yeah. Right.
And so
when we do teach the marriage seminars, Frank will take the men for a session, and he's heavy onto that, and tells them, if you're into that, your wife will never be what you're seeing. It could be your daughter, you know, and he comes hard on that. And we need to do that more in the Christian community, because do our ministers talk about that on Sunday morning?
Right. Ours does. But most do not.
Right.
Most do not. Right. Okay. So I do want to steer a little bit toward when I sent you the book, the first thing you I think you called me. It's like, I just read it once. I'm reading it a second time. And it was this explained so much. And so you had known for several years that about Sally's abuse when she was younger, but what was it about reading through that book that answered some questions, filled in some gaps, checked some boxes? Do you remember?
Not really.
Okay, that's all right.
part of my problem getting older, I learn some things and I forget them pretty quickly.
Right.
And I go back and read it and I go, oh yeah, that's okay.
Well,
reminders are good.
One of the things that, so I don't know if you even know, you can listen back to our podcast most recently talking about my trip to Scotland, but we're trying to also address addiction and trauma and train churches. They need the same thing we do here. And I just had the opportunity to be there. I spoke one day and talked about the way your brain is actually changed by what happens when you're young and things happen to you. So just like connections that are made, the survival part of your brain, as opposed to the thinking, problem-solving your brain, part of your brain being more developed. If you're in peril when you're young, if you're in survival mode a lot, the survival part of your brain gets very strong. The processing, thinking, calendar-keeping part of your brain is not developing during that time, you know, as much. And so And what you see is later behaviors where it might be that somebody is easily startled or easily angered or runs away from things or shuts down and freezes or whatever, that those responses are like helpful for somebody who has experienced a lot of trauma because that's their defense mechanism. That was the thing that people kept saying. I would go to the next group and the guy that had set up a lot of my meetings would say, tell them that thing, because it so connects these dots between God created our bodies and our minds and our everything to work in a particular way. And when we follow the rule book, you know, we've got the cheat codes. If we do things the way he says, it all goes very smoothly. But as soon as we don't, it's not just, you know, people are like, oh, well, it's just a psychological thing and we can just do a little therapy. No, it's like every inch of your being was created around this thing, and which is so hard to shake later. You know, it's like, no, this is who I was grown to be. And so now you really do have to become a new creation physically, spiritually, mentally, emotionally.
Well, even for me, sometimes Sally, my wife, has a reaction a certain way. In my mind, I go, this is coming back from her childhood. She's very defensive. She doesn't want to be hurt again. And even the slightest thing to me is very minor. To her, it's big. And I don't criticize it. I just have to learn to accept it.
Well, and that is the thing, just being able to give people the benefit of the doubt. It's like, okay, there's a reason. And I don't know, we have the iceberg picture in the book, but we've really ramped up our use of the iceberg analogy, where what you see is that behavior on top or the response or the words or whatever on top. But all of that below the surface is why those are coming out. And we don't know what's in everybody's iceberg. We didn't know much at all of what was in your iceberg until just a few years ago. And you may still not even know what all is in your iceberg, but I've talked to people before that, you know, there'll be a sound or a smell or something, and immediately you're back in this place and you lash out and people are like, what is the matter with her? It's just bacon, you know, or whatever, you know, but there's something that triggers that memory and it's just automatic.
It can be such an innocent thing in a life group or a Christmas party at your church, and they wanted to break the ice, and they asked the question, what was your best Christmas? Well, let me tell you, I immediately think of my husband. His Christmases were horrible. His father set the mattress on fire one night. He would bring men home from the bar. Or if that question was asked about, tell me your favorite thing as a child, where do I go with that? I freeze in my brain. I had no childhood. I can't tell you about that. So in a small group, in a Christian group, we don't know where people are coming from. And sometimes questions like that, which are so innocent, can trigger something.
Right. And I think that's an important thing for people to hear, that they're, maybe you get icebreaker questions off the internet or whatever, but really think through where this might put somebody in panic mode or whatever. And one of the things that I have, even at ETSU where I teach, we give choices. You know, it's like, answer one of these five questions or something, where somebody can choose something that doesn't freeze them, you know. Mm-hmm. But even having that, just to that way you're not shaming the people who made the questions for not knowing, but just thinking through how could this land. I work in a public higher education institution, and I happen to be a Christian conservative, which is not necessarily terribly common there. But one of the things that I do is I offer to interpret for people who are trying to talk to people like me. So it's like I get to read through things to see how they're going to land. You know, we want to send this out to the community, and I'll read through it to look and see what's going to offend the constituency, you know, which is great. And so if I had something that I really am very different than, I have a fellow that works with me, and I'll say, would you read through this? He's an atheist liberal, self-proclaimed, and he will read through things for me so that we kind of are trying to put ourselves in the other shoes and not offend people and, you know, say it so that's understandable. So, but yeah, I think just thinking through those things and hearing you say that, it's like, I know that that could happen to people, and I tell people about that, but it really validates it when you say, yes, this is uncomfortable to me, that it has a lot more clout from you, because I'm just kind of guessing what it might make you feel like, but you're saying, no, it really does make me feel that way. So is there anything else on this topic that you think that you'd like to add? Anything that you, any questions you came up with while you're sitting there?
No, I would just encourage pastors and churches to wake up and realize this is an issue. And when you look at your congregation, you've got a certain percentage of wounded people out there in different areas. And you need to make it in such a way that they can come out or get them to somebody else. When after Sally's father died, she talked to the pastor, and the pastor was wise enough to say, I can't handle this, and sent her down to a counselor where mm-hmm. she got her help.
And he paid for it.
Right.
The church paid for it.
That's nice.
So part of education, I think, even for me on the demonic, so many pastors say, no, I don't want to talk. I'll talk about that a little bit later. But we need to, when I'm talking to pastors, I'll say, realize that God maybe wants to use you in a way to help some people in your church that you don't know how, but God can teach you if you really want to learn. And there are some very wounded people that you can't just put a Band-Aid on it. There's a much deeper problem. And maybe you're not qualified, but there's got to be somebody else. So again, pray for wisdom. Says, God, guide me to the right people.
Yes, and you might not be aware of it, but for years I have taught a Bible study to women that have had abortions. Mm-hmm. And the only women that are in my group, they've had abortions. And I counsel each one of them. And I remember one of them said to me, well, have you had an abortion? And I said, no. And she said, well, then you can't be my counselor. You can't be the one to be running this Bible study. And I said, well, when you go to a doctor and you find out you might have cancer, do you say to him, do you have cancer? Have you ever had cancer? And he says, no. Do you walk out? No, you go, because he has some answers for you. And my answers will be to help you through this abortion and the sorrow and pain that you have. And I think what had happened to me as a childhood helped me understand the pain these women were going through. And for the rest of their life, they'll remember, I aborted that child. Like they said to me, I look on the playground and I see a 9-year-old and I think that could have been my child, but I aborted it.
Right. Right. Working in the field of addiction, I dabbled as a teenager, but I have never been addicted to a substance. My sister was, died from it, but it wasn't me, but there's so often people say, oh, you have to have experienced it. But that leaves out a whole lot of the army that we can build to be supportive. And so I am definitely, I think if God can give us wisdom for everything else, he can give us wisdom for that as well.
Yeah.
Next time on Intrinsically Motivated.
In experience, in practice, I see weird stuff and I can't explain it. And maybe it's mental health and maybe it's spiritual and sometimes I'm not entirely sure, but God knows.
This has been a podcast powered by Uplift Appalachia. To learn more, you can find us at upliftappalachia.org.